right, gracias. All right. We're going on our 30th year here in Santa Cruz. 30 years. And tonight is a very special night for, personally for myself, because I get the honor to introduce a peace warrior. A peace warrior that has showed me a way to look at not only at myself, but in terms of the work that we do throughout this world. And because of his words, and even before I met him, his words had already touched me, because he had been touched by the same people that I had read about for many years. I met Jim in 1993 at the National Peace Summit in Kansas City, when we brought 26 cities, gang members from all over the country to come and talk about peace. And we asked this government for support to help us to bring truce. And we could have had a major, I mean, the Bloods and Crips had just come together to form a truce. And we had some of the major players in that. There's some people in this room that were there. And Jim came, and he watched, and he wrote about what we were doing. And here we are, you know, many years later, struggling with the madness. But something that I learned in that peace summit, that I learned, is that in terms of the work that needs to be done, especially in our prison system. And I've learned something from Jim in terms of going to these institutions, and that's where I've dedicated a lot of my latest years to work. For those people, they go into these institutions, are very special people. These are our brothers and sisters that are locked up. And as a peace warrior myself, and trying to teach myself to live a nonviolence life, I would like to welcome our brother Jim as a peace warrior, as we would do it in our neighborhood. And with my brother, I'm going to call my brother David Beaudry. We go into the institutions and we stand there as doesn't matter what color we are, but we all go with an open heart. And when David has a gift, music and singing, and we take this song, it's called Street Church. And every time we go into the prisons, the inmates request that, you know, because it says it makes them feel like they're in a street church. And that's what Jim does. He puts street churches out there in the neighborhoods of Washington, D.C. and Houston. So thank you, Jim. And when I ask my brother David to come up and sing a song for you as our peace warrior out there.
Both. That's the way we do it. That's the way we do it in street church.
Is it on? I don't know if it's on. I'm going to say a brief thing. Jim, my mom was a songwriter and a social worker too, and she loved Sojourners, you know, from the very beginning. And we lived in Echo Park in Northeast LA, and she just admired your organization so much that one of her goals when she retired was to hopefully work out something to go out with you guys and finish the rest of her life volunteering with you. But she didn't get to stay around that long. But it's an honor for me to be here. A big honor.
Say a prayer for the wild-eyed man that just can't find no sleep at night. He spends all day staring at the sun and swears that he can't see no light. And on a south side corner is the prince of pimps. He's got an ebony cane, and he walks with a limp. Conducts his business with the ladies from an obnoxious pink Mercedes. They need a little street church. Lonely souls can find a friend. They need a little street church. Amen. They need a little street church. Lifting up the people. I'm talking about a street church. Oh, hey, that's the church without a steeple. Well, looky here, strutting down the aisle. It's old Pastor Blaster. He's a modern Pharisee, an apostle of disaster. Oh, how he loves to talk. He lets the hot air blow as he tries to lead the blind to places he would never go. He needs a little street church. Lonely souls can find a friend. He needs a little street church. Amen. He needs a little street church. A little something that works. Lifting up the people. I'm talking about a street church. Hey, that's the church without a steeple. So when we're walking down the street, and I'm talking about wherever we may live, let's look inside our hearts. We all got something we can give. Open up those sleepy eyes. Reach out with your hands. Let's spread the love of God all around the land. Let's have a little street church. Lonely souls can find a friend. Let's have a little street church. Can I have an amen? Amen. Let's have a little street church. A little something that works. Lifting up the people. We're talking about a street church here. Hey, that's the church without a steeple.
Let's give our brother, peacemaker, friend, Jim Wallace, a big welcome. Santa Cruz, welcome.
Well, we need a little street church. Yeah? A little street church. Thank you, Nane. I met this brother at the Gang Peace Summit, National Peace Summit, in Kansas City. And I could tell he was something special right away. You had about, 125 guys, 26 cities. We had Crips and Bloods, Vice Lords, Gangster Disciples, Latin Kings, Cobras. And then we had a press conference at the end. And sometimes, Nani will tell you, the sort of the ways of the street took over the conference. And when the national press showed up, I thought it was very interesting that the one leader that everybody trusted, black and brown, enough to be the spokesperson. Everybody there was this young man I just met named Nane Alejandres. And he is a nonviolent warrior in the best sense of that term. And he is my t-shirt supplier. I mean, I got drawers of Barrios t-shirts. And every time I see Nane, I get a new t-shirt. And tonight was no exception at dinner. Because I'm in Santa Barbara. It's 831. 831. It says Santa Cruz, but it's a lot lower, and I'm not going to show you that one. Scott said maybe at the reception. I am really pleased to be here. I've got dear friends here. Scott, Kenny, and I go, we're trying to figure out when Scott and I met. It was a long time ago. And Scott has been one of those nonviolent warriors that makes sense of nonviolence. Nonviolence, to be credible, must answer the question. Violence pretends to answer, but in a better way. And I'm so proud that this is one of many events to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Resource Center for Nonviolence here in Santa Cruz. Because all the good folks there have been doing this for such a long time, and I'm proud to be associated with them. There's a lot of confusion about this whole subject, faith, politics, religion, public life. I mean, let's face it, religion, and we're here tonight from many, many diverse traditions, religion in America is a very confusing subject. Like my son Luke, he came up to us when he was 7 to Joy and I one day, and he said, Dad, Mom, I'm worried about Max and Jonah. Two of his second grade pals on the baseball, Little League baseball team that I get to coach. He says, I don't think they believe in God or Jesus. I think they're vegetarians. So Joy and I took him out to Oregon on the God's Politics book tour where he'd meet some godly vegetarians. You know? And it got him straightened out. But the confusion is a little deeper than the misunderstandings of a little kid. When I was on the Jon Stewart Daily Show one night, we had a really good time. I mean, some night they put you on these TV shows on book tours. Some nights you're on the O'Reilly Factor, other nights you have fun. No, Bill and I are actually getting along pretty well these days. But Jon Stewart was more fun, and we had a great time. But the emails that came at the end were really amazing to me. Thousands of them. From mostly young people. I lost my faith, they said, because of television preachers, bad religious fundraising, pedophile priests, cover-up bishops, White House theology, they said. Or more stunning, they said, I was amazed by this. I didn't know you could be a Christian and care about poverty, or care about the environment, or care about the war in Iraq. I didn't know. They really had never heard. And when they heard, though, they got all excited. So I meet these kids on the road, and I was in Detroit, my hometown, one night staying at the Days Inn, and I walked up to the front desk, and a 19-year-old African-American kid, she was the desk clerk, and she said, oh, Mr. Wallace, welcome to the Days Inn. You have an upgrade. Upgrade the Days Inn. Mm. These are the things you live for on the road, you know? So she said, can I show you to your room? I said, sure. Takes me back, and I just said, I'm curious, who gave me the upgrade? He said, well, I did. I watched Jon Stewart. I read your book. It was awesome. Or the next day I met this 17-year-old kid in the airport. He said, just want to shake your hand. You're the only Christians I see on TV, and don't throw up afterwards. This is high praise, you know, high praise. But from the first few weeks out, when God's Politics was published, I began to feel something. And I sensed when these book signings turned into town meetings every place we went, in bookstores, in the revivals, you know. I felt something was happening. Something was just getting revealed that was already there. And a lot of folks said, I thought I was the only one who felt this way, who didn't agree with all the voices I always hear all the time. I thought I was alone. And they look around the other folks and say, and now I don't feel alone anymore. And all kinds of folks were coming, and probably the same kind of folks that are here tonight. First, we did have a new generation of evangelical Christians coming. Young students at Christian college campuses who care about putting their faith into action. There are two great hungers in our world today, two great big hungers. The hunger for spirituality and the hunger for social justice. And the connection between the two is the one the world is waiting for, just begging for. And these kids, you know, their parents prayed that they'd follow Jesus. You got to be careful what you pray for, you know? Because they're just following Jesus places that their elders never been before. Then we had a whole lot of Catholics coming who didn't feel like they wanted to only vote on one issue. They want to talk about Catholic social teaching, which I think you're going to hear about some tonight. Then a whole lot of mainline Protestants came. My wife, Joy Carroll, was one of the first women ordained in the Church of England about 15 years ago. And for those of you who know English TV and English humor, there's a hit TV show called The Vicar of Dibley over there about a rural priest who comes to a parish and they think they're getting Jerry and they get Geraldine instead. Anyway, it's on PBS now. My wife was the script consultant and role model for the show, so she's known as the real Vicar of Dibley, you know, over in Britain. But now she's with the Episcopal Church. And all those mainline churches, people were coming out because they felt kind of, churches like this, they felt kind of dissed. By the way, Shanna, I love the way you talk, but it doesn't sound like Santa Cruz.
South
Santa Cruz. Well, thank you for having us tonight in this wonderful mainline Protestant church, but your folks were coming out, and they kind of felt dissed by this whole conversation, you know, as if they're not really Christians, some folks seem to think. Then a lot of black church folks were coming up, because you know what? This has been a very white conversation. When they talk about evangelicals, they mean white evangelicals. They don't mean the historic black churches, you know? And so then a whole lot of Latino Christians and Asian American Christians coming out, because they're changing the face of all of our churches. And they wanted their voices to be heard. But a lot of rabbis were coming and bringing their congregations because they liked the sound of Isaiah being applied to domestic policy and Micah to foreign policy. And then a whole lot of young Muslims were coming out. And in my class at Harvard, I was saying, I've got a lot of young Muslim women who are some of the best students I ever get. And, you know, they have a very different view of things. And they tell me they're fighting for the heart and soul of their own tradition. A battle going on, and they're fighting for the heart and soul of their faith. Then a whole bunch of folks came out and said, I'm spiritual but not religious. It's a new denomination. It's just growing like crazy. Ben Cohen, you know Ben and Jerry's ice cream? Ben tells me he's spiritual but not religious. I said, Ben, if you offered free ice cream, you could be the bishop of this thing. So Ben is thinking about that. He's thinking about that. And then every time, there are people who said, and maybe some folks tonight, I'm not particularly religious. I'm not even spiritual, really. I'm secular. I'm kind of agnostic. But I felt welcome tonight. Because you're talking about a moral discourse on politics that we all need and that we're all needed for. So every night I just say, welcome to the conversation. In Boston, first night, this kid came up to his kid's book sign and he said, I'm gay. Thanks for making me feel welcome tonight. But you know what? It's easier to be gay in Boston, come out as gay in Boston, than as religious in the Democratic Party. But now that's changing too. So the first thing I want to say tonight, as I've traveled the East and West and Midwest and Mountain States and Texas, and I have felt something happening around the country, something new, something very fresh. I want to talk tonight about movement, what it means to think movement. And I want to make an announcement tonight that I think many of you may be happy to hear. And the announcement is this. I'm convinced now, after a year and a half of this, that the monologue of the religious right is finally over and a new dialogue has just begun. I was doing a radio show this morning and they said, what? He said, your subtitle of your book, the right gets it wrong and the left doesn't get it. What does the right get wrong? Well, that's easy. On the right, you know, they're so comfortable talking about faith, values, religion, God, so much so you think sometimes they believe they own the territory, maybe even own God. But then they narrow everything to one or two issues, abortion, same-sex marriage. Those are important issues. They deserve a much deeper, better conversation than we've had. But I am an evangelical Christian. And when I find 2,000 verses about poor people in my Bible, I insist fighting poverty is a moral values issue too. And so is protecting the environment, which a whole lot of young evangelicals now call creation care. That is a moral values issue too. And when almost as many American young people have now died in Iraq as we lost on 9/11, and tens of thousands of Iraqis are now dead, and that violence spirals more out of control every day, we must insist the ethics of war. When you go to war, whether you go to war, and whether you tell the truth about going to war, those are moral values issues too. So they're coming now to talk about moral values again. You know, we got an election coming up. You know, and I say, bring on the conversation. Let's talk about moral values ought to be at the center of our political discourse. But how do you define what moral values are? We've got to have a deeper, broader conversation like we haven't had before. And I see it happening all over the country. You know, I was reminded when Nani was talking tonight about the prisons, and we were talking at dinner about prisons in Venezuela. I thought I'd tell a story about a speaking invitation I got a while back, several years ago. It wasn't a great church like this, a university, a town meeting. It was the inmates at Sing Sing Prison wrote and said, could you come and speak to us, the prisoners? Sing Sing is in upstate New York. You know the phrase, up the river? That's the Hudson River, that's Sing Sing. That's where it came from. It's tough, a tough prison. It sounded interesting, so I wrote back. I said, yeah, when do you want me to come? So this young brother writes back on behalf of all his pals. He says, well, he said, we're free most nights. He was a real comedian. He says, we're kind of the captive audience here. So I went, and the prison authorities were very generous. They worked it out. And I got left alone in this room in the bowels of Sing Sing for 5 hours with 80 guys. And we just talked about faith. Because the New York Theological Seminary has a program inside the walls of Sing Sing teaching Masters of Divinity. You can become a preacher inside the joint, and you graduate when your sentence is up. And many of these guys were in the program, and I met this one young brother who I'll never forget what he said to me that night. He said, you know, Jim, almost all of us at Sing Sing are from just about 4 or 5 neighborhoods in New York City. The whole prison, 4 or 5 neighborhoods. It's like a train, he said. It starts in my neighborhood. You get on when you're 9 or 10 years old. And that train ends up here. At Sing Sing. What an image, a fast-moving urban train beginning in only certain zip codes, going to inevitable destinations like Sing Sing. But this young brother had had a spiritual conversion. And he looked me straight in the eye, and he said, "When I get out, I'm going to go back and stop that train." So I'm in New York doing a town meeting a few years later, and guess who's up front? Convening the meeting on poverty, stopping the train. That's what I call a faith-based initiative. You know? He understood something that I hope we can all learn. He understood that faith is for the big stuff. The things that seem too hard, too much, they overwhelm us. The odds are against us. That's why we call it faith. My Bible says, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, what can you move, Reverend?
A mountain.
She knows that text. I want to say that we got some mountains to move that strike me as being a job for faith. We got fast-moving urban trains going on still. We got 3 billion people, half of God's children, living on less than $2 a day. You know, the life expectancy gap between the rich places and the poor places now in the world is 40 years. Death is now a social disease. 30,000 kids died yesterday and will today and will tomorrow because of lack of clean drinking water. Diseases none of my kids or their friends will ever die of, and just not enough food. Bono calls that stupid poverty. If you break it down, 30,000 kids, it's one every 3 seconds. Get alone in a room sometime this week and just snap your fingers and think about the kids. Gordon Brown, you've seen the papers, is about to be the Prime Minister of Great Britain. Tony Blair ever gets out of the way. And Gordon Brown once looked at me and said, for the first time, we have the resources, the knowledge, the technology, the information to end extreme poverty as we know it. We couldn't do it before, now we could. What we lack, he said, is the moral and the political will. Looks across the table and says, that's your job in the churches, in the faith communities. That's your job, to create the moral and the political will. Politics in Washington, D.C. is failing to solve the biggest issues. Take them one by one: global poverty, global warming, Darfur, which, please, in the next 3 weeks, focus on Darfur. The African Union forces are leaving in 3 weeks. If the aid workers leave too, the whole population will be utterly vulnerable to marauding bands of rapers and pillagers and murderers. Or HIV/AIDS, or a response to terrorism that is killing us. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. Toughness multiplies toughness. In a descending spiral of destruction, the chain reaction of evil, hate begetting hate, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or we shall be plunged into the dark abyss of annihilation." I spoke yesterday about 9/11 in Berkeley, and I said, you know, if you can't see the face of evil on September 11th, you're probably suffering from some kind of postmodern relativism. But to say they're evil and we are good is bad theology, and leads to bad foreign policy. And until we drain the swamps of injustice in which these mosquitoes of terrorism breed, we will never defeat terrorism. But politics isn't getting it. And so I don't invite young people to join politics, but to move politics, transform politics, change politics. And what does that? Always have been social movements. And the best social movements have spiritual foundations. I'm a 19th century evangelical, born in the wrong century. Because back then, the 19th century, you know, the evangelists were also abolitionists. The revivalists were also reformers. They helped lead the battle against slavery. They fought for women's suffrage. They fought for child labor law reform. Charles Finney was the Billy Graham of his day. I love Charles Finney. He's called, my seminary called him the father of modern evangelism. Well, he invented the altar call that we've seen now made famous. But you know why? Because Finney was having so many converts, people coming to faith, he wanted to sign up his converts for the anti-slavery campaign. That's why we first had the altar call. We previewed a film in L.A. just a couple days ago. It's going to be the Toronto Film Festival. And it's about the great British parliamentarian William Wilberforce, who was a convert in the Wesleyan Revival, and he's the one who wrote the anti-slave trade legislation. His 200th anniversary is coming up in March of next year, and Walden, who made Narnia, has made this film on William Wilberforce. And he'll be presented to the American people and the world next March. And Wilberforce became a Christian through John Newton, who was the one who wrote the song Amazing Grace. Albert Finney plays John Newton in the film. And John Newton wrote the song Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound to save a wretch like me. But this brother wasn't suffering from existential angst. He was a wretch. He was a slave trader. And his faith turned him around and became an abolitionist. And he met this parliamentarian, this young Wilberforce, and he was converted by Newton. And Wilberforce presented the anti-slave trade legislation 30 times until they won. And when they won, he died 3 days later because his work was done. And I saw it depict this movement, this powerful movement that turned a nation around. You see, people of faith have done big stuff before. It's time we believe we can do it again. I see that happening across the country in strange places. I was at Pepperdine just a few days ago, you know, conservative Christian school, they say. And I'll tell you, the 2,000 students in convocation, I was told afterwards, they always are talking during convocation, rustling papers, earphones, newspapers. After 5 minutes, they were dead silent. And they listened, right? You felt you're speaking to their hearts. Afterwards, they mobbed the front. We had a voluntary Q&A 2 hours later. 400 came. I'm seeing this at campuses across the country. Something is happening I've never seen before. And it isn't just the college kids. At these events, you know, kid walks up and, how old are you?
14.
Really? In school? Yeah. What year? Freshman. High school. Parents aren't there. Mom and dad just there with his friends. Or in Minneapolis, I looked up from the book table and there was this little tiny girl. I said, how old are you? She says, I'm 11. You're 11. What did you get from the night? She says, well, I think we're just going to have to change the world. I said, yeah? Who's going to do that? I think people like me. So the next time, I'm in Tacoma, Washington, right? And I look up, here's a little girl, and I look up and she grins, 9! I tell her story in Seattle the next night, and I look up, here's the littlest one of all. And she says, I think I'm the youngest so far. I said, now how old are you, sweetie? She says, I'm 8 years old. I said, I stopped the line. what made sense to you tonight? She said, well, when I heard about you talking about that silent tsunami that's killing all the children every day, like me, I was sitting there thinking, if I'm a Christian, I better do something about that. In the third grade, I told my harvesters that the next week, you know, I got Muslims and Unitarians and Jews and Christians, and what they all think, they're activists. And I said, if you want to lead this thing, you better move fast, because the whole generation coming behind you going to push you out of the way. You know? Just for the record, I believe in the separation of church and state. But that does not mean the separation of moral values from public life, nor the banishing of religious language from the public square. How do we do this in a way that respects democracy, that respects our diversity, that respects our pluralism? There are more Muslims in America today than Presbyterians. Don't tell the Presbyterians, but it's true. How do we have a whole different conversation where all of us are welcome to join together in this struggle? We can't do these things by ourselves. We're all going to be needed. We sang that tonight. We're all going to be needed for this. How do we do that? How do we each be who we are and then have a new conversation and then a new kind of action? It was a wonderful thing when a Democrat got up to speak at our conference this June on this topic of faith and politics. His name was Barack Obama. And he said, more fundamentally, the discomfort of some progressives with any hint of religion has often prevented us from effectively addressing issues in moral terms. Some of the problem here is rhetorical. If we scrub language of all religious content, we forfeit the imagery and terminology through which millions of Americans understand both their personal morality and social justice. Imagine Lincoln's second inaugural address without reference to the judgments of the Lord, or King's I Have a Dream speech without references to all of God's children. Their summoning of a higher truth helped inspire what had seemed impossible and move the nation to embrace a common destiny. Our failure as progressives to tap into the moral underpinnings of the nation is not just rhetorical, though. Our fear of getting preachy may also lead us to discount the role that values and culture play in some of our most urgent social problems. After all, the problems of poverty and racism, the uninsured, the unemployed, are not simply technical problems in search of the perfect 10-point plan. They are rooted in both societal indifference and individual callousness in the imperfections of human beings. Solving these problems will require changes in government policy, but will also require changes in the hearts and minds of our people. Talk to Nane sometime about how you got to change the hearts and minds of the kids who the system has told aren't worth anything. We have this thing in your chairs, you see, a covenant for a new America. It's a plan, an outcome-based plan, to do something about poverty and not just blame each other for the problem. Washington, D.C., my city has this habit, both sides do it. They take a problem, first they want to make you afraid of it, then they blame it on the other side. Then take a poll to see who won. The election is just the last poll. What they are promoting is a politics of blame, and a politics of fear, when the nation is hungry for a politics of solutions and a politics of hope. I'm so tired. I'm so tired of conservatives walking up to me and saying, the problem with poverty is out of wedlock birth and family breakdown and personal responsibility and better choices. And liberals say, the problem is just funding childcare, healthcare, affordable housing. I know that neither of them live anywhere near poor people. There are choices that kids in my neighborhood make that just plunge them into the depths of poverty. The difference is the suburban kids get 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 12 choices. Second chances, our kids maybe get one. But there are bad choices, and there are bad policies and structures and institutions that make poverty inevitable. It will take both personal and social responsibility to overcome poverty. So I want liberals to talk about out-of-wedlock birth, reweaving the bonds of family and community, and conservatives to talk about strategic investments in housing, education, healthcare, and childcare. That would blow Washington, D.C. wide open. And that's what we're trying to do with the Covenant for a New America. I am hopeful these days, not about Washington, but what I see happening across the country. There's a spirit in the air. There's a movement afoot. A lot of people have gotten involved. One of them was just a rock star till he got converted. And he spoke at the presidential prayer breakfast this year. And Bono said, you know, it's kind of weird, you know, a rock star speaking at the prayer breakfast. I'm not a man of the cloth, unless leather counts. But then he preached. God is in the slums, in the cardboard boxes where the poor play house. God is in the silence of a mother who has infected her child with a virus that will end both their lives. God is in the cries heard under the rubble of war. God is in the debris of wasted opportunity and lives. And God is with us if we are with them. Afterwards, I said, man, that's the most religious I've ever heard you sound. He said, yeah, I'm getting carried away. He is getting carried away. It's about time we all got carried away. I want to talk about, just finish with what I think the big choice is, the big choice. And I think it's especially true of those of us who are progressives. The big choice. I was told as a kid the big choice is between belief and secularism. That's the big choice. I don't think there's issues there, but I don't think that's the big choice. The big choice today is the one between hope and cynicism. That's the big choice. You see, I like the cynics. The cynics are realistic. They see the world as it is. They don't look through rose-colored glasses. And cynics are always against the bad stuff. They really are. They're almost always against all the bad stuff. And maybe they even tried to change the bad stuff for a while. They got out there, they began to get active, but things didn't change. They got disappointed, disillusioned, and they began to withdraw and retreat to this place called cynicism. Well, you're still against all the bad stuff, but you don't think it could ever change. So you surround yourself with a bit more security. And cynicism becomes a buffer against commitment. Hope, on the other hand, is not a feeling. It's not a personality type. Hope is a choice. It's a decision you make because of this thing that we call faith. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, says the book of Hebrews. The evidence of things not seen, or my best paraphrase still is, hope means believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change. On the book tour, I got to go back to Atlanta at the very end, which I love to go to Atlanta. I love to preach in Atlanta. Atlanta is a good place for preaching. I went to my favorite preaching place in Atlanta, which is the Ebenezer Baptist Church, home church of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I walked into this brand new sanctuary, and Joe Roberts was retiring, the pastor, and he welcomed me. He says, you've been to the old Israel, this is the new Israel, 2,000 seats, but it felt intimate. They're all full that night. And I remember that first time at the historic church across the street, when we as a nation decided finally to celebrate Martin's birthday as a national holiday, the first birthday official celebration, Ebenezer had this peace and justice service, and they invited this young white preacher to come and preach. And I was terrified to be in that place, in that pulpit, but I went, and sure enough, I got there, and I just froze. I just froze, because that pulpit, Martin Luther King Jr. had preached in that pulpit. His father, Daddy King, had preached there. The whole movement had preached there. And what in the world is this young white preacher sitting there preaching in that pulpit? I was a bit tepid. I started by saying, well, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he was for justice and peace, and probably we should be too. I mean, it was powerful. And this voice down left side boomed back at me. Oh, help him, Lord, help him! Come on, you man, you're supposed to preach! And so I did a little bit. Oh, you're not there yet! You're not there yet! And then he's the amen corner of Ebenezer Baptist Church. If you've ever, I love preaching black churches, call and response. He just said, he welled me, he mercied me, he amened me. Till I was preaching and prancing and sweating, I preached my heart out. And I ran down afterwards. I said, it was Deacon Johnson was his name, the amen corner of Ebenezer. I said, you just pulled that sermon right out of me. And he said, stood up with his hands on my shoulders, he said, it's okay, young man, I've raised up many a preacher in my time. And what I remembered that night, what I felt that night, was that pulpit at Ebenezer Baptist Church had pulled out our best stuff as Americans. We got bad stuff in us. My understanding of human nature says we got some bad stuff in us. But we got some good stuff in us too. Bad religion pulls out our worst stuff, our fears, our divisions, our hatreds, those things that divide us from each other. Good religion pulls out our best stuff. Always has, always will. So I want to leave you with a commission tonight from a young woman that Nani would have loved. She was a young kid from our streets, our neighborhoods in D.C. She was so smart, she went to Yale, got herself a Ph.D. Now, when you're a young black female, got a Ph.D. from Yale, you can kind of write your ticket. And she came home instead to the streets, where the children of the streets had won her heart. And Lisa Sullivan became the best street organizer I ever knew. She was rap, hip-hop, she loved, she hugged, she scolded, she confronted. She's what the nonprofit world calls a capacity builder. And she was a star. She was a future. She was my friend. And she was on our board. One day I got a call. Lisa had a big heart. But none of us knew her heart had a heart ailment, a defect. She didn't know. In 3 weeks, before she was 40 years old, Lisa was gone. So Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund and I just held each other at Lisa's gravesite and just wept, because Lisa was the future. But she leaves us thousands of kids that she turned around, but she leaves us a commission that I want to give to you tonight. And the commission, it's the very end of the book, but it's become for me not an epilogue, it's now a commission. When people would say, Lisa, the problem is too big. The streets, the apathy, the corruption, the violence, it's too big. And we're too small. Our staff, our resources, our faith. It's too big, we're too small. And Lisa, we don't have any leaders anymore. We don't have any Martin Luther King Juniors anymore. It's too big, we're too small, and we haven't got any leaders. She'd get mad, really angry, and she'd say, don't say that. Don't say it's too big and we're too small. And never say that we don't have any leaders anymore. Don't you understand? She'd say, don't you understand? And she'd look us straight in the eye and she'd say, you got to understand. We are the ones that we have been waiting for. We are the ones that we have been waiting for. People of faith have done big things before. They have shaken nations to their foundations. They can do big things again. A whole generation that I meet is ready to run. They want, the churches ask for the edges of their lives, and they want an agenda worthy of all of their gifts, energy, time, and all of their lives. We're not asking people for too little, too much. We're asking for too little. Time has come to build movements that shake nations and change history. It's already happening. We've done it before, and we can do it again. My friends of Santa Cruz, you are the ones that we have been waiting for. Thank you very much.